This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the man who videotaped the cops who killed Eric Garner has another day in court. France takes its place among the most racist nations in the world. And Frantz Fanon, who wrote The Wretched of the Earth, would be 90 years old this month.
But first, activists in Oakland, California, brought Martin Luther King birthday activities to the streets with a 96-hour campaign of direct action and civil disobedience. Kat Brooks of the Onyx Organizing Committee said the mobilization includes a march to the train station where police officers killed Oscar Grant on New Year's Day, 2009. One of the problems with wage and direct action campaigns in the 21st century is that it's been so long since there has been a mass movement in the United States. Folks have forgotten what direct action really is.
And so we're even currently making a differentiation between direct action and civil disobedience. So where civil disobedience may be taking up a picket sign or marching or even blocking an entrance for a while but then moving when the state tells you to move, we're really clear that in this definition of direct action, we are taking the space as opposed to asking for the space and keeping that space as long as we say so, whether that's a commemorative, you know, amount of time, an honorary amount of time, or if it's until a demand gets met or whatever the groups are deciding. But we are taking, reclaiming that space as our own in direct defiance of the state and the state's policies. And that's what King encouraged folks to do. And he was really clear that that was the only type of activity and action that was really going to push society to transform.
Yes, if Dr. King were alive, and we ask that question every year about this time, if he were alive, what would he be doing?
He'd be shutting it down. We actually have, that's one of our memes for the weekend, is if MLK were alive, he'd be shutting it down. Right? He'd be locking himself to federal buildings, as the Third World Coalition did this morning. He'd be organizing folks to take over freeways. He'd be sitting in school board meetings and taking over those meetings. And as his legacy for the later part of his life, he would really, in Oakland in particular, be connecting loudly the bloody dots of capitalism and gentrification with the systematic oppression and violence against Black and brown people in this city.
And he'd be taking up the banner of Black Lives Matter.
Yes, Black Lives Matter, which means Black Power matters, which means Black Resistance matters. It's all of the above.
Some people aren't comfortable with the Black Power and Black Resistance side of that coin.
Some people aren't comfortable with the actions that we're taking, period. But, you know, the way that I've sort of gotten my own piece around it is if you weren't comfortable 450 years ago when we were asking not to be slaves, you weren't comfortable when we were singing spirituals asking not to be slaves, you weren't comfortable when we were marching peacefully in the streets and not a window anywhere was broken, right? So you weren't comfortable then, you weren't going to be comfortable today. And if you're not comfortable now that we are demanding unapologetically that we are able to thrive in a society, you just don't have to sit with that uncomfortability.
And of course, the purpose of direct action is the opposite of making folks comfortable.
It sure is. It's supposed to create an uncomfortable tension that forces conversation, forces policy change, and forces transformation of the society that we live in.
What are the various affinity groups that you're working with in the Bay Area demanding of the police or the people who the police work for or the people who control the police?
Sure. So there are both local and national demands. So locally, there are demands that are connecting economic violence with police violence. So there's a development here called Coliseum City. We're making some very real demands around local hiring, that 50 or 51% of those people are disenfranchised, so particularly folks on parole or probation, victims of the criminal justice system. We are asking for the demilitarization of the police force, so send your tanks and armor back to the military. There's a conference here that happens every year called Urban Shield, and we're demanding that that no longer be in Oakland. We want a database. There's no database that collects information about how many people the police have killed, and that federal funding be tied to that database. So if you have a long list of abuses and your police department is clearly violating human rights and civil rights repeatedly, then you don't get money to continue, right, violating the rights of the people. So those are just a few of the demands that folks are working with. And those demands were actually presented to Oakland's brand new mayor this morning in her office by a group of young black women in a really powerful manner. It echoed through the entire City Hall chambers.
And the central question, who controls the police?
Right. So the federal government, our mayor here, Libby Schaaf, who is technically OPD's boss, right, in a city that has been exploding around police terrorism, you know, for at least 6 years now since the murder of Oscar Grant, she woke up and told us that her most important priority were the police. Not the homeless, not the hungry, not education, not gentrification, but the police. She wanted the police to feel that she had their back and she was going to support them in doing whatever it was they had to do. So we see that we really have an uphill battle here in Oakland to getting the powers that be, city council, our mayor, to understand that we're done asking nicely for the police to stop terrorizing our communities.
So you believe she was saying that the police are her main constituency?
That's what she said. It basically, she said, I want the police to know they are my most important priority. And her very first day in office, she spent with them from 6 o'clock in the morning to midnight, her whole day. She saw no one else but them. So it's not even an assumption or what I think. It's what she has clearly communicated to us. And that she would communicate that in the midst of what is happening, not only in Oakland, but across the country, signifies to me that she's either completely detached from the community and what's happening, or she's very firmly planted herself on the wrong side of justice.
That was Kat Brooks of the Onyx Organizing Committee in Oakland, California.
Ramsey Orta, the young man who took the video of police choking Eric Garner to death in Staten Island, New York, has a court date on January 25th. A grand jury failed to indict the police officer that killed Garner, but they did indict Orta on charges of passing a handgun to a 17-year-old girl. Orta says the cops set him up. His lawyer is Alton Maddox, the veteran human rights attorney who lost his license in 1990 after his involvement in the Tawana Brawley case. We asked Alton Maddox what kind of defense he'll mount for Ramsey Orta.
I think the record really pretty much in this case speaks for itself. One, the most important argument is that this was not a loaded weapon and it was not capable of firing. And so you start from that premise. But preceding that, I think it's very significant that Ramsey Orta had actually videotaped the chokehold death of Eric Garner in July. And on August 1st, the medical examiner's office came back with an autopsy report indicating that Eric Garner was the victim of a homicide. And so, obviously, if you put the videotape of Ramsey Orta together with the classification of death of the medical examiner officer, it actually equals probable cause, which warrants an arrest. And it's interesting that the very next day, Ramsey Orta had been unlawfully arrested by the New York Police Department. And after that, the process for an indictment was swift.
Yes, and Ramsey Orta is saying that that is no coincidence that he was set up.
That's absolutely what his position is, and that's certainly what my position is as well.
And how do you intend to pursue that?
Well, in the basis of this particular case, the real issue is any argument that you can make to the jury. And although I know that Staten Island is a hostile area, and I have certainly practiced law in Staten Island on some very hostile cases, but the main emphasis will be the argument to the judge first to dismiss the indictment, and upon failing to do that, the argument will be made to a jury properly selected. That is the capability of Staten Island to make that argument there.
Well, the Staten Island grand jury was certainly not hostile to Officer Pantaleo, who they refused to indict, but Mr. Orta, they did indict.
And I think that's really an unexpected pattern in Staten Island. I mean, it is the most racist of the five boroughs, and you know, I can certainly say that by experience. And, of course, in addition to experience, it is the home many of the members of the New York Police Department and members of the New York Fire Department and other civil servants that work in the city.
Well, what does this say about the grand jury process in general? That is, grand juries seem to have no problem with indicting anyone whose case is brought before them by the prosecutor, unless they're a cop.
Well, I think, one, you have to start with the proposition that a grand jury can and will indict a ham sandwich. And so, therefore, the key issue is who is in the driving seat. And obviously, that's the real problem that you have with prosecutors, because they have such a close relationship with the police officers who are their allies in the, quote, fight against crime, close quote. Now, in this particular case, the problem, though, is that really, and I think this is something that has to be hammered out, and maybe Ramsey Order is a good case in order to do that, is that they are actually different grand juries. And it is true that some grand juries are what is called investigatory grand juries, and those particular grand juries may be dealing with issues where probable cause is not clear. However, in my opinion, I think it's the argument that has to be made that it is an abuse of discretion for a prosecutor to have a case where probable cause is very clear on its face, and instead of conducting a preliminary hearing as is permissible, the prosecutor goes to a grand jury. And that's where the problem really lies. And, you know, I've been involved in the criminal justice process for many years and been involved with many cases. And on top of everything else, I'm probably the only attorney in the nation to have secured two indictments by special prosecutors and not by grand juries. And so I somewhat have a feeling for how that process goes on. And I'm saying now it's time for a new reawakening of the people in New York City as to how the grand jury should be employed.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you're saying that prosecutors use the grand jury in cases involving cops as an excuse for not indicting when they could just proceed and make the charge themselves.
Well, you're a quick study. That's exactly what I'm saying. And that is a problem that has routinely happened where attorneys have not taken a stance, meaning defense attorneys, because unfortunately, you also have a situation where the judicial system is hostile to defense attorneys who make waves. And so the threat of some discipline is usually enough to keep defense lawyers in check. And so you not only have the prosecutor who's working with the police department, but you also have the judicial system itself. And much of that work has to be addressed and certainly has to be changed.
Well, you certainly have a reputation of making waves. Mr. Orta chose you. You helped him get bail. Lots of groups have rallied to his defense. Can we anticipate, if it goes to trial, a political trial?
Well, it certainly is a political trial because it is politics that is playing a real part in all of this. And what is interesting now is that Congressman Graham, who had represented Staten Island, had pled guilty in federal court and is stepping down as a congressman. And Mr. Donovan, who is the current district attorney of Staten Island, is seeking his post. So I don't know how this is going to play out, but it could be a good watch for anybody who is interested in justice.
And what's the timeline that Mr. Orta has to look forward to?
Well, he has a six-month timeline in terms of the indictment being pursued or dismissed. One thing that I do is to address that as a defense attorney, and I won't necessarily be at liberty to say on this broadcast how I do it, but I will say that the time limit of 6 months will be strictly enforced.
Now, Mr. Orta was called as a witness before the grand jury that refused to indict the officer, along with other people who were witnesses to Eric Garner's death, and he reported that the grand jurors didn't seem to be paying any attention to his testimony, which lasted only 10 minutes, and other witnesses before that grand jury have said similar things.
And I think you make an excellent point, because the point that you're making, or the inference that follows from the point that you're making, is that his grand jury testimony, as well as the grand jury testimony of others, in addition to any grand jury testimony that related to the death of Eric Garner, should be discoverable. And I think that now, with a insistence that the provisions of the current procedure law be enforced, that we will get an opportunity to see all of that testimony before the trial actually commences.
Ramsey Orta said that the police were following him around because he had done that videotape of their treatment of Mr. Garner, subsequently then arrested him. He's out on bail. I guess he's laying low in terms of the Staten Island police these days.
Well, that's a good point. He's laying low as he possibly can lay, but that does not mean he has not been free of any police harassment, because he has. And so certainly we will be seeking what normally is available only in a domestic relation case, and that is an order of protection from the police department to make sure that they do not interfere with any of his constitutional rights.
Have you been satisfied with the community response in terms of support for Mr. Orta?
Well, I've been satisfied to the extent that the community has been aware of what is happening. And what I'm appreciative of in terms of this broadcast is that you know that I am a victim of censorship. And so I'm precluded from any commercial radio or television station in terms of the people having an opportunity to hear my views. So a broadcast like this is very important and becomes extremely important, because the education of the community is absolutely necessary in order for us to achieve our objective.
And now I'm going to have to ask you if the restrictions that have been placed on you will in any way hinder Mr. Orta's ability to defend himself.
Well, no, it won't be, because I think they should be very clear now that I don't operate with restrictions. And basically, that's why I wrote the chief judge a couple of months ago, letting him know what is happening, because I have been a victim of forced retirement, not disbarment, a retirement, because of the work that I was doing here in New York. And so I was able to survive because of elements of my mission that I wanted to pursue and to satisfy. But now we are in a situation where virtually every attorney in this city, including the attorneys for the Garner family, in their pursuit of, quote, justice, close quote, have turned a deaf ear to Ramsey Orta.
On another subject, Loretta Lynch with the District Attorney's Office in New York, your part of the world, is President Obama's choice to succeed Eric Holder as Attorney General. You've watched her in operation. What kind of Attorney General do you think she'll be based upon her work in New York?
Well, I'm going to base my answer on the public facts and the available facts. And that is that she got a lot of notoriety in the Abner Louima case, which resulted in some police officers going to prison. However, I believe most people misconstrue what really happened in that case. And it is true that some police officers did go to prison for sodomizing Abner Louima. My position is that this was necessary for Charles Hines to give up the case as the local district attorney in New York in order for the federal government to obtain a higher objective. And I think that objective is really one of the roots of the problem that we are really facing throughout this nation. And that is that it is better when you are facing a black person to use the heavy artillery in your hands to kill that person than to allow that person to survive. And the reason, in my opinion, why that is important is because you go from a pain and suffering case to a wrongful death case. And wrongful death cases not only more difficult to prove, but they're also more difficult to enjoy any damages. And the second point I think that is very clear is that when you pursue a shoot-to-kill policy, it also means by definition that the witness, and sometimes the only witness to the crime, is now unavailable to give testimony. And so that tilts the favor to the police department and not to any family specifically or to any class of people in general.
So you're saying that cities and states and counties face less liability if police kill a person than if they wound or maim them, and that influences police lethal behavior?
Well, what I'm saying is that when we went to law school, tort law, T-O-R-T, law was a first-year course, and you were taught in tort law that a pain and suffering case can be a lot more advantageous to the victims than a wrongful death action. So it is basic hornbook law that support what I said in that situation, and it's only necessary for lawyers to analyze that. Now, the problem has happened, and this happens also in the face of legal history. The Supreme Court has, in my view, has never been kind to black people. And in the middle 70s, there was a case called Bates versus Arizona, which basically ushered in a new kind of lawyer, and that was the ambulance chaser, who is more concerned about hush money than about justice. So there are roots in what we are seeing now, but these are legal roots, and I think we have to very seriously do a serious analysis of the problem, and I think most people are not up to the task.
But again, you seem to be saying that killing folks on the street is the alternative of choice among police, and that that is sanctioned by the state, which doesn't want to get sued for crippling somebody.
And that's my point. And my point is that if I was a lawyer for the city, and I suppose I would really look it out for the city and not for anybody else, that would be my advice to police department, that when you have somebody on the ground, make sure you do the right thing, and that is snuff life out of them so there won't be a pain and suffering case.
That sounds very much like the Obama administration's drone policy, which appears to be that it's better to kill people that one charges with terrorism than to take them prisoner and have to put them away in a Guantanamo and worry about them.
Well, I think the record shows that President Obama was at the top of his class at Harvard Law School, and I'm sure at that peak he was able to come to that conclusion.
Attorney Alton Maddox, speaking from New York.
France, the nation that enslaved much of the world and has killed millions of Africans and Asians, continues to insist that its enemies are just jealous of its high moral values. Ajamu Baraka doesn't think so. Baraka is an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report and co-founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network. He says the slogan, Je suis Charlie, has become an arrogant rallying cry for white supremacy.
The framing of the shootings in Paris as one that supposedly was an assault on the Western value of free speech was used as a launching pad to expand that to the idea that the assault was an attack on Western civilization. And therefore, the moves toward expressing solidarity or unity was, in fact, an expression of upholding, advancing, privileging the ideals, perspectives, views of what people imagine to be a European Western civilization. So the Je suis Charlie thing was transformed into a defense of Westernism, of Western civilization, as opposed to what it was, which was a particular kind of a terrorist attack that could have very easily been explained as part of the blowback from French colonial policies and current French policies in the so-called Middle East and North Africa.
Yes, many of us have trouble figuring out what Western civilization is and what French values are. France, historically, has killed millions. What kind of values are we talking about?
Those are, in fact, the values. But basically, the values are grounded in a colonial division between people who are recognized as full humans and therefore are respectful of human rights, and those peoples who have been consigned to the category of the non-humans or non-being. Those people are the ones who are then eligible to be murdered, to have their lands taken, to be enslaved. Those are the values that, in essence, many of these people who were embracing the Joshua Charlie label were, in fact, upholding. So that is part of Western civilization. All the construction of the lies and the imagination of what this civilization is supposed to be is a lie, but it's a very powerful lie that is expressed in the kind of solidarity that we saw at the White Power March on Sunday and the ease in which identification with Europe among Europeans in Europe, the continental Europe and the U.S., the ease in which that takes place.
Ever since the assault on the cartoonist's office, lots of French folks have been calling this their 9/11, and many of them seem to savor it. We know how the aftermath of our 9/11 in the United States turned out, with reaction, further curtailment of civil liberties, and a heightening of anti-Muslim racism.
And that's probably going to be what is going to continue to unfold. We know that right after the attacks on the publication, there's been a spike in anti-Muslim violence, anti-Muslim attacks on mosque individuals over the last week or so. So we see that happening. Plus, if you contextualize this within the realities of French society and in, to an extent to, across Europe, the anti-Muslim, anti-Arab sentiment has never been stronger. And it's part of the fuel that has ignited the resurgence of a right-wing movement across Europe. One of the interesting consequences, I think, that we'll see in France is that the political party that will probably benefit the most from this shooting and the framing of this as an attack on Western civilization is Le Pen's National Front. Even though, you know, they were excluded from some of the festivities, the themes, again, that were raised are things that they have been raising. It plays right into their anti-immigrant, anti-Arab, and anti-Muslim positions. And the anger and the fear that's been manipulated is something that could very easily and will, and I would predict, lead toward more influence and greater power for that racist right-wing political party.
Yes, it seems that for many French people, the very presence of Muslims and Arabs and North Africans in France is considered a pollutant, an assault, and an affront to French values.
And unfortunately, that's a position that a number of European states have taken. The increase in asylum seekers and economic refugees from North Africa landing on the shores of Italy, we find the same kinds of anti-immigrant racist sentiments being expressed. Across continental Europe, there's a real concern that the European integration project is threatened by these migrants. Part of that project was supposed to allow the free flow of individuals across borders, but because of the concerns of Europeans with these outsiders being able to move freely move across Europe, we find that there's been a backtracking on that commitment. And the consequence of that is that it's helping to erode the sense of a European identity and European integration. So, again, these outsiders, these non-European elements, are seen as the real problem for the advancement of a collective European interest.
Looking at France from a Black American perspective, one sees many parallels. Several studies have shown that French people of Arab descent are stopped on the street by the police in greater numbers even than sub-Saharan African descendants in France.
Well, I'm going to tell you, Glenn, as someone who has been to France probably a few dozen times, I even lived there for a while, I know for a fact that in fact happens. Well, I didn't think there was much of a distinction being made between North Africans and Africans from below the Sahara, because it appeared to me that everybody was getting harassed. So it's not surprising. That's part of the sense of discrimination, of exclusion that many people feel in France. I place France as part of the tripartite states of the most racist states on the planet, in my opinion. It's France, Israel, and the U.S. Because, and some people might be surprised by that, but the racism in France is insidious in the sense that it's pervasive, but yet it's not recognized. So, yeah, the harassment is something that's real, and it's something that's felt. The laws that were passed that limited how people, in particular Muslim women, were able to dress in public, the generalized anti-Arab and in particular anti-Islamic sentiments that are normalized in France, part of just everyday discourse, is something that Muslims and Arabs feel very intently, but their concerns are completely ignored. So it's a sense of feeling under siege in France. So there are some similarities there, but in some ways, it's even more intense because of the lack of or the inability to really establish reliable allies in the broader French society.
And this, of course, is very important because the gunmen who attacked the cartoonist's office were not from Syria or Yemen. They were from France.
They were homegrown Frenchmen, if you will, who now people are trying to explain to themselves, how were these individuals, quote unquote, radicalized? Well, you know, even when I was being exposed to the ideals of radical Islam via the internet, everyday living in France can, quote unquote, radicalize a number of people in that country, in particular people who are living in the French suburbs, who have been subjected to police violence all of their lives, who are unable to secure steady employment because of their ethnic background. You throw in then what they see as a anti-Western, almost anti-French movement represented by a radical Islam that provides them an explanation for their discrimination and a vision for how that is reversed, and you have the formula for numbers of people joining that movement. And then you have the political environment in which, and people have to be reminded of this, these individuals who were involved in an attack, it's not clear yet, but it seems to be that either they went to Yemen and received training. I've seen reports that says that one or both of them ended up in Syria fighting against the Assad government. If that's the case, then we have to be reminded that up until about a year and a half, 2 years ago, these individuals from across Europe were allowed basically to travel to the Middle East, to travel to Turkey, to go into Syria, to engage in the Western collaboration to overthrow the Assad regime. And many of us argue that they were playing with fire, that the Assad government was not going to fall that quickly, and that they were, in fact, enhancing the power of these radical Islamic extremists that was going to, at one point, blow back on them. And I think that's exactly what may have happened in this case.
Yes, the French are now saying that they are at war, sounding very much like the Americans after 9/11. But the French, along with the Americans and the British, have been arming the very jihadists that they now claim to be at war against.
Exactly, and that's the hypocrisy, the contradiction that many people around the world see. And that's why and we all were looking at this display in France with real wonderment. I mean, it was the self-righteous expressions, the historical amnesia in terms of how these forces have been developed over the last couple of decades was really astonishing. If people are concerned in France about Islamic terrorism, then they should be more concerned about the activities of their own government. The same should be said for the U.S., that we have these stories that come out that basically say that the U.S. and the French and the British were well aware of the financing of groups like ISIS, that their intelligence services were involved in providing training to these militants, including individuals that ended up in the ranks of ISIS. But because the main objective was to advance U.S. interests in Syria, to overthrow the Assad government, a blind eye was turned, and the enhancement of these forces was the consequence. And the blowback in France, I believe, is really just the beginning of what's going to happen across the continent and even back in the U.S., the same scenario that developed coming out of the enhancement of the Mujahideen in the fight in Afghanistan during the 1980s.
There are many chickens coming home to roost, but the tripartite and the rest seem to have no way to extricate themselves from this contradiction.
Well, they won't. It will have to be from the people themselves to demand an accounting to these policies, to demand an accounting to how resources have been used to provide training and weapons to these illegal forces, to demand that their governments cease and desist from supporting these movements and to move toward a political settlement of the fight in Syria specifically, but to understand that you're not going to defeat a weaponized Islamic fundamentalism with just weapons on the other side. That basically is a political culture phenomenon also. And until you begin to address some of those issues, all you're going to do is end up more militarily and ideologically enhancing the very forces you say you are opposed to.
And folks should remember that France is not only the former colonial power in Algeria, where the gunmen who attacked the cartoonist's office are descended from, but also the former colonial power in Syria.
Exactly. And this issue has to be placed within that framework of understanding the ongoing colonial relationships and the ongoing efforts at decolonization. Part of the strength of Islamic fundamentalism is that it has framed itself as an anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, cultural, religious movement, if you will. And because of the decimation of the secular radical left in the Arab and Muslim world, this space was created for these forces to develop. So, yes, this has to be placed within that realm of understanding. It really does. And going back to the connection with the U.S., I think it's important for people to remember that as we make this existential cry about Black Lives Matter, that we reflect on what we saw last week in Paris. That basically the so-called world leaders coming together, this massive rally and the European-wide expressions of solidarity were all in response to these 17 people who were murdered in this couple of incidents in Paris. During the same weekend that reports were coming out that almost 2,000 people may have died in Baga, Nigeria. But yet there was no expressions of solidarity in terms of that being part of the worldwide anti-terror movement. Nothing. So basically, again, the privileging of white life is what this whole Just We Child League is really all about. And we have to understand that when we talk about Black Lives Matter, yeah, they matter to us, but not really to anybody else.
That was Black Agenda Report editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka.
This month marks the 90th birthday of Frantz Fanon, the black psychiatrist from Martinique who fought alongside the Algerians against French colonialism and wrote the seminal books The Wretched of the Earth and Black Skin, White Masks. Fanon died of leukemia in 1961. In Nairobi, Kenya, the Pan-African Baraza celebrated Fanon's birthday with a presentation by Dr. Lewis Gordon, a professor of philosophy and African-American studies at the University of Connecticut. Dr. Gordon said The Wretched of the Earth was originally titled The Damned of the Earth.
One of the things Fanon points out, if you don't fight for your freedom, then you're always held hostage to the possibility of return domination. So part of your dignity, your humanity, is for you to stand up for who you are. But the thing that Fanon did was then Fanon argued that every generation has its mission. And what Fanon means by this is if we get back to that example, you see, the problem is the population trained for decolonization. If they continue those practices, you're going to have a society built on pathology. The ending of the book does something very unusual. He gives case studies of showing the brutality of violence on both sides. In other words, he showed not only that the French were torturing, but he also showed the kind of killings that were being done by Algerians. And the question is, if you're trying to do a propaganda that creates heroic revolutionaries of violence, why do you show stories of little boys killing their best friend? Of a man thinking of his mother and eviscerating a woman? Why do you tell these stories? And what Fanon is trying to tell you is that you cannot build a society on trauma. There's something that's rather interesting. What younger generations need is a conception, a telos, a maturation process in which they see the uniqueness of the responsibility they have for the world they're building. And within that framework, then, it means that those who are ushering the new post-colonial moment, they must now be overcome. So you have this ongoing practice, and in fact, praxis that's needed. And within that framework, Fanon, if you want to use old language, was trying to argue now for what's called an open dialectic. A closed dialectic is the old kind of Marxist thing that says, you know, you have one group fight, you now expand the universal, another group will take over, and you have freedom. Fanon says it doesn't work that way. Because if you use that model, you're going to be stuck with the old argument of why those in suffering, those in bondage, those under difficult conditions must always wait. But Fanon says that that is just like that old argument of imposing one model as a shoe, the one shoe that fits all. There's a reason Martin Luther King wrote Why We Can't Wait. There's a reason the Haitians fought. Every group has to understand that it has the responsibility to set the conditions for its freedom and its emancipation. So in effect, what Fanon closes the Damné de la Terre with, and it comes back to this very important issue, is that he argues that it's not enough to fight for material change. You need also to set the conditions for very new concepts. The conditions that led to where we are actually brief blips in the history of our species. But what the direction in which it will go completely depends on every one of us here. So in effect, Fanon is arguing for the kind of responsibility we take over the very knowledge we have as the oxygen through which to set afoot the new humanity. Well, that very creative young man ended up dying on December 6th, 1961, in Bethesda, Maryland. And what's very unusual is that if you look at one of his plays, he described the question that he struggled with. He said he did not want to collapse into the whiteness. But he did collapse into the whiteness. And how strange it was, because leukemia is about white blood cells, isn't it? How strange it was that he faded into white. But his book, as we know, The Damné de la Terre, became the textbook of the revolution. It became a text that people began to read in a way, because what they didn't understand is that Fanon was really talking to everybody. And what Fanon understood is something that a lot of people miss. Tells you that the universal in truth is white, but Fanon has shown that that is actually one perspective. But the black perspective is very different. It's not that the black perspective is complete. It's that the black perspective realizes that it has a relationship to other perspectives. And that means that it knows it's not the universal. It is that which is struggling in a universalizing activity. Precisely because, as human beings, our task is never done. It's just that we're building, struggling, fighting always to make it better.
Dr. Lewis Gordon of the University of Connecticut, speaking in Nairobi, Kenya.
Black people in the South American nation of Colombia are determined to make sure that their lives matter as mechanized gold mining operations threaten to overrun their ancestral lands. Charo Mina Rojas is an organizer with an Afro-Colombian women's movement that has been trying to halt illegal gold mining in the country's northern Cauca province, We asked Nina Rojas why the task of confronting the outsiders has been taken up by Black women.
Women have been raising this issue before the Colombian government because we have over 2,000 excavators, machines that are doing illegal mining in Afro-descendant territories in the region of North del Cauca, one of the great regions for gold mining. And these miners are in these territories without any permission from the communities.
And these illegal miners, they also are armed, aren't they?
That is correct. And these illegal miners are also armed. They are also threatening people. That is preventing them from doing this activity. So they are threatening the leaders, they are threatening women, and they are threatening the whole communities.
You say the government has not interfered with these illegal miners. Are they in cahoots with them?
Many of them are, particularly the local authorities, are very involved in these illegal activities. For one thing, the police are responsible for preventing that this machinery that has no legal authorization to be circulating in the area. And what we know is that they get paid in order to allow this machinery to be in the territories. We know that local authorities own some of this machinery and protect the miners and receive money from these illegal miners to do these operations in our territories. And many are simply responsible for not doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is taking our suits and demands and acting to remove this machinery and these illegal miners, investigating the threats, investigating some of the environmental impact that is causing this on the basins of the rivers. There is a lot of corruption and, of course, no political will whatsoever in the national government to respond to this situation.
I thought that there was an agreement with the Colombian government to recognize the rights of Afro-Colombians in those lands.
Well, there is a law, actually. The Constitution recognizes there is a law and several constitutional court orders that mandate the recognition and the respect of collective rights of Black communities in those territories. The government doesn't recognize and doesn't follow them, and that's one of the reasons that we have this great and dangerous situation in these communities in the North del Cauca, because the government really doesn't recognize and doesn't follow the different laws. It's not just one, the different laws that protect the rights to people in the Black territories.
Why have women taken the lead in defending Afro-Colombian rights to the land?
Well, several reasons. One is that mining activity, the artisanal mining activity, is mainly an activity for women, and women is severely impacted with the presence of this machinery in the rivers. They haven't been able to work and do their artisanal work anymore. The other reason is that there are direct impacts in women. There is a lot of prostitution. There has been rape of women by these illegal miners. One of our main leaders is a woman, and she is under death threats, and we feel that we must protect her. There is the cultural and physical integrity of the community is jeopardized for the presence of these illegal miners. So women feel that after all the different actions taken, all the different agreements with the government, and nothing happening, we had to mobilize, we have to take action, and we have to ensure that our rights and the communities and people is protected. We did reach some agreements with the government that the government has complied yet, and what we feel is that we have to continue mobilizing and taking direct action until the government finally assumes responsibility and is held accountable.
The Colombian government claims that it has reined in the death squads. Are death squads still active in your area of Colombia?
Absolutely, they are active. And those are some of the forces that threat us and our leaders. they are in many ways legitimized and allowed to stay in the territories and persist in their activities by their own authorities. There has been proof that direct relationship between army and police with these groups exist, and that they continue to be working together, and that just the fact that the government doesn't want to recognize them legitimize their actions and their presence in the territories and the continuance of their building up power and control on the territories.
How have these large-scale mechanized gold mining operations interfered with the livelihoods Afro-Colombians?
You know, these communities have been practicing artisanal mining. This is very individualized work, one person at a time doing it, and it's what has been possible to persist for centuries. These are communities that have been there from 1636. So the presence of these machines has a heavy impact in the land, in the basins of the river. What a machine does in one day is something that tens of people have done in many, many years. One machine can do a terrible damage to the land, to the basins of the river, just in one single day. One scoop of that machine can destroy a kilometer of land in one day.
So we're not just talking about violations of Afro-Colombian rights, but violations of the environment as well.
As well, right. The environmental impact is extremely serious. There is also use of mercury to clean up. What they do is they scoop the gravel to look for the gold, and the way, the easy, the fastest way to find it is using mercury. You wash out the gold and put it up. And all these ways goes back to the river. So not only they are damaging the ecosystems because they are making these big holes in the land, but also there is mercury in the water. And this is the only source of drinkable water that the community has. They are damaging the ecosystem, so many plants, many things that the people will grow in those regions are now not able to grow anymore. And the recuperation of these areas that they damage take many, many, many years. So it's a great economic and environmental impact, besides the cultural and social impact that the presence of these miners have in the region.
Do Afro-Colombians have sufficient representation in the government, in the legislature, to protect these traditional ancestral rights?
Unfortunately, there are many blacks in different government instances, but they do not represent the interest and the rights of the black communities and the territories. And that's one of the reasons that we have to mobilize and we have to make the pressure that we have been making on the government is why we have to take direct action, because we don't have a real voice that represents a real interest in the rights of black communities on those positions.
And when you say take direct action, what do you mean? What kind of strategies have you employed?
We go to these areas, like just on December 29, we have to go, women, men and women, about 30 people, many of us women, go to the area where the miners are, where these machineries are, and we force them to leave the area. Of course, this is extremely dangerous because they are armed, but we have to expose ourselves to make sure that these people understand that these are our territories, we have rights there, and we are ready to protect them by all means necessary. So we just go there and pressure them. The last time, fortunately, authorities showed up and we avoid a bloody confrontation. But we have decided that these actions are going to continue until all this machinery is expelled from the area and we get people to understand that the owners and authorities on the black territories are the communities, the people that have been for centuries ancestrally working and protecting them.
And that's it. for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.